So, I want to discuss tonight the Lehi, or the Stern Gang, the Lochamechi Rut Yisrael. But before we get to that, we'll get to that only in the second half.
Is that the same name,
the same group? Same group, yes. Okay, in order to get to that point, I want to discuss why it is that the Jewish community of Eretz Yisrael in the pre-state era developed three different underground militias, paramilitary groups. Why wasn't one enough? I mean, one would have been preferred. A strong one, a united one, would have been in the better interest of the Jewish community. So having three and being divided is bad. How did that come about? That's the question for tonight. And it all begins, really, with the beginning of the Haganah in 1920. The Haganah was started in the context of the 1920 riots, and there were two schools of thought about what kind of defense the Jews should have for themselves. Vladimir Jabotinsky, who basically founded the Haganah, was of the viewpoint that there should be a Jewish military force that was authorized by the British and had authority to patrol the streets and to protect the Jewish community and be paid for by formal taxation. That was not going to happen. There had been the Jewish Legion during the war, and that was decommissioned and disbanded, and the Haganah never achieved the kind of recognition that Jabotinsky wanted. In fact, then he was arrested and spent some few months in jail in 1920, and then was only released in a general amnesty under Herbert Samuel, together when the Mufti was also released from prison. And instead, the Haganah was developed as an underground organization, not an above-ground organization, and it wasn't under his control. But it also wasn't completely free-wielding, autonomous, but rather it had to be under the civilian authority of some representative institution of the Yishuv, that you don't want to have guys with guns without a civilian overseeing them. Because if you don't have a civilian overseeing them, what's going to happen? You'll have military juntas running the Yishuv. You know, that's bad. So the initial organization that controlled the Haganah was the Histadrut. But the problem with the Histadrut being the controlling organization of the Haganah is the Histadrut is identified as a left-wing body. Now, in theory, it could be for all political parties. The bottom line is labor Zionism. So the Haganah is under the thumb of labor Zionism. In 1929, that changes, and the Jewish Agency becomes the authority supervising the Haganah, but the Jewish Agency also is now coming under the thumb of left-wing Zionism, that whereas up until that time, the World Zionist Organization and the Zionist Executive was in the hands of the likes of Weizmann and the centrists, in Eretz Yisrael, by the late 20s and going into the 30s, the Labor Party is the dominant party, and so they're controlling the guns, they're controlling the Haganah. This is unacceptable to certain elements within the Haganah, who are chafing under the leadership of a political ideology that they don't like, and also they're dissatisfied with the meek nature of the Jewish Agency's response to anti-Jewish rioting by the Arabs. They want a more firm and heavy-handed style of response. So in 1931, there is a breakaway. Avraham Tehomi, who was one of the leaders of the Haganah, takes a few thousand of his buddies and breaks off and forms the Haganah Bet, the second Haganah, or the Haganah Lu'umit, the nationalist Haganah. A variety of names were given to this alternative Haganah, this breakaway. It was not under the control of the revisionist party. So this is a mistaken notion that many people have, that the Irgun from its inception, because this will morph into the Irgun eventually, that the Irgun was a militant arm of revisionist Zionism. It really wasn't. Many of the members of the Haganah Bet were themselves Beitar youth who graduated out and now were grown adults or young men, and so they had revisionist sentiment, but not all. In fact, there was a nominal leadership group of politicians from a range of parties that was supposed to oversee the Haganah Bet. and that included the revisionists, but also the general Zionists and the Mizrahi, the religious Zionists. Had Mary Bar Ilan was one of the members of that committee that was supposed to give guidance, you know, moral suasion over the Haganah Bet. And so Tahomi's group existed side by side with the so-called real Haganah, or the primary Haganah, from 1931 up through 1936. So Jabotinsky is not in the country, and he, as the leader of the Revisionist Party, and then after 1935 as the leader of the new Zionist organization, the NZO, is the political big shot who tries to influence the activities of the Haganah Bet and is one of the members of that committee that's supposed to give them guidance, but he's out of the country, so he can't really give them day-to-day operational guidance or control. In 1936, the Arab riots break out. And when that happens, there's a question of what the Jewish response should be. And 2 weeks ago, we discussed at length the notion of havlaga, of restraint. And the havlaga policy was that of the Haganah, under the auspices of the Jewish Agency executive, notably Ben-Gurion. But in truth, even Tahomi believed in Havlaga. And even Jabotinsky, to an extent, believed in Havlaga and did not want to countenance offensive attacks against Arab civilians, at least early in the Arab Rebellion throughout 1936. So the rank and file are getting angry about the lack of action, but the leadership is committed to a more restrained and tame policy. So, I don't know about that. Oh, well, yeah, you took from the Jewish point of view, I think, but from the Arab point of view.
No.
Okay.
Been a
yeah, that's true. So, in the summer of 36, there was discussion about unification. The unification of the Haganah Aleph and the Haganah Bet back into one united Jewish military command. And the problem was that in order for that unification to occur, the condition imposed by Ben-Gurion and the left on the right, which was a much smaller organization, was that they would have to accept the discipline imposed upon them by the formal yeshuv leadership. Now, what is the formal yeshuv leadership? The elected leadership, which means the Jewish National Council, the Vaad Le'umi, and the Jewish Agency Executive, which is appointed by the World Zionist Congress. So that's dominated in large part by the Mapai, the Miflegat Pole Eretz Yisrael, the leftist party. And will the rightists be willing to do that? Will they subordinate their military agenda to the elected leadership of the community? Unfortunately, Jabotinsky refuses to do that. So even though Tahomi on the ground in Israel is inclined to do that, Jabotinsky is recalcitrant and doesn't want to allow for this unification. One of the reasons why unification was seen as so important at that time was because the Peel Plan was in the offing. There was talk that when the British would send a delegation to check out the situation in Palestine, that they might very well suggest partition, which would mean a Jewish state. In fact, they do suggest partition when the plan is published a year later. Of course, it never comes to pass because it's overtaken by events and partition wouldn't occur until 1947-48. But at the time, there was real talk about it. And what happens if all of a sudden a Jewish state is handed to you and you have Arab enemies in country and beyond the borders of the country? You need a military. Well, are you better served with two weak Haganot or one strong Haganah? One. So this was the motivation in 1936 to, as quickly as possible, overcome whatever tactical or maybe even ideological differences that might have existed and have unification. But it doesn't happen. Then, what occurs in 1937 is the outbreak of further hostilities and even more intense hostilities. So in 1937, in the springtime, Tahomi drops out of the Haganah Bet and takes with him his loyalists back into the main Haganah. How many did he take with him? It's a machlokes among the historians and among those who were involved. The Irgun, who wants to say that Tahomi was like a turncoat, says he only took a few hundred guys with him. However, the scholars claim he took half the second Haganah with him back into the first Haganah, and left behind only a rump organization that would form itself into the Irgun. Okay, so they take on the name Irgun Tzva'i Le'umi Be'eretz Yisrael. The Irgun Tzva'i Le'umi means the National Military Organization in the Land of Israel. Its leader is its political leader is Jabotinsky. The folks on the ground in Israel accept his control over the military apparatus. This is something that had not existed previously. He may have been a revered figure by the Haganah Bet between 31 and 37, but he didn't have absolute control. Now he'll supposedly have absolute control. The problem with absolute control means if you're not there, you really don't have absolute control. It's a farce. But it's a farce that they're going to play along with. He was bouncing around between London, Warsaw, and America. New York, yeah. Although spending most of the late 30s in Poland, until 39, when he jumps over across to go to New York. Well,
he died
August 4th, 1940. So, he was 60, or 59.
That's a baby today.
Yeah. So, who takes over the Irgun if Tahomi is going to jump ship? The answer is that Jabotinsky appoints Robert Bittker. Robert Bittker is a name you probably never heard of. Okay, he was a Polish Jew who had military experience in the 1920s in Russia, and then went to China, and was living in the international zone at Shanghai. Was the head of Beitar in Shanghai. I'm not really sure how large a contingent Beitar had in Shanghai, but whatever. He was the boss there.
Before the war,
in the late 30s, yeah, and came to Israel. His problem was, although he had military experience, this is not a military. This is an underground fighters organization, and he also doesn't speak Hebrew. So, you know, he spoke Yiddish, and he spoke Polish and Russian, but he didn't speak Hebrew. And the Irgun was mostly people who had been in country a while and wanted to communicate. It was important to them to communicate in Hebrew. So his tenure didn't last very long. He was replaced by Moshe Rosenberg, who also didn't have a very long tenure. It only lasted less than a year. In late 1937, things get hot in Eretz Yisrael. The Arabs are back to killing people again, and whatever hiatus in the riots that was created for the sake of the Peel Plan was over, and with the plan's publication, the Arabs are back to, you know, really killing at a rapid pace. So the Irgun wants to fight back. No more Havlaga, now that they're under real right-wing control. And so they're going to attack the Arabs, including the killing of civilians by various means, including significant bombings in Haifa, in Sfat, and elsewhere. The leadership of the mainstream Zionist organizations and the leadership of the Yishuv will condemn the more horrific of the Irgun attacks in late 37, early 38, and at one point in time say that if the Irgun doesn't stop it, we're going to start arresting you people, Jew arresting Jew, to shut you down. Yeah.
At what point is Wingate dealing with
Palma? So Wingate is dealing with the special night squads in late 37, at the same time, early 38, at the same time that the Irgun is doing its own dirty business. So there really is a parallel between what the most aggressive and egregious of the Haganah types are doing and what the Irgun is doing. Although one is doing it in conjunction with a British officer, and the others are doing it just exploding milk cans and pickle cans in Arab marketplaces.
Is Wingate still part of the British military?
Yes, he was.
Active,
yes.
They knew what he was doing?
Yes, yeah.
Okay,
so I'm glad you asked that question, because when Ben-Gurion made a threat in early 38 that if the Irgun doesn't control itself and refrain from carrying out its more egregious type of bombings, that the Haganah and the Yishuv formal institutions are going to crack down on them in a rough way, Jabotinsky responded, "The civil war will not be restricted to Palestine. It will spill over into the Chutz La'aretz, to the diaspora." Was that a bluff? Was that real? Who knows? I mean, remember in 1933, there was a very heated election between the Mapai and the revisionists, and things spilled over into the diaspora, especially into Poland. And there really was Jew-on-Jew violence in 33 and 34 at the worst moments.
In Palestine,
and even in Poland. There were not. I don't mean anybody got killed, but I mean there were fisticuffs and the like. So, in the end, this didn't come to pass. The Haganah would not do any serious measures against the Irgun in late 37, early 38. Some modest measures, some people were arrested, or there was Mesira to the British authorities, but it wasn't like it would be later on in the Saison of 44, 45, when it was really bad, when the mainstream Yishuv organizations were really ratting out the right-wing terrorists. So, now what happened was that because the Irgun was becoming very feisty and killing a lot of people and making the situation in Eretz Israel almost out of control, and the Arabs were also killing a lot of people and the situation was getting out of control, there was some attempt at reconciliation in the middle of 1938. However, in this instance, instead of Jabotinsky being the one to nix the unification agreement, it was actually Jabotinsky instead of Jabotinsky ruining it, it was Ben Gurion who ruined it. That the leadership of the Irgun had, under David Raziel, come to an understanding with the Haganah. But that understanding would not mean formal unification of the two groups. It would just mean a collaborative leadership, that there should be a high command, that you won't take an offensive measure unless it was approved by our leader and your leader, and then it becomes kosher and you can go out and do whatever you're going to do. So that was the arrangement. But Ben-Gurion didn't like it because he wanted absolute control. And since he wasn't going to get absolute control, he said, forget about it, there's no unification. Now, who is David Raziel? So Raziel was born in 1910 in Vilna and came to Eretz Yisrael as a child, was a religious, a very devout person, studied in the Merkaz Harav Yeshiva, and then was a student at Hebrew University, then dropped out of Hebrew University in 1935 to become a full-time fighter type, was one of the founding members of the Irgun when Tehomi broke off back to the Haganah, and was a very bold and courageous and aggressive person. So David Raziel is the leader of the Irgun from the middle of 1938 until his arrest on May 17, 1939. Raziel does not like to be told to hold back and refrain from, you know, targeting Arab open places where there might be civilian population. When he was told that the Yishuv authorities were against him because of it, he said, they can kiss my fill in the blank. It's in the record books. That was his exact words. Then, when Raziel is arrested, the day that the white paper is proclaimed, the Irgun is now under the hands of Yechanoch Kalai, who was a lesser tier figure and is now in a situation where you need to fight back hard because the British are a complete enemy after the May 17th white paper. But the interesting thing is, the Haganah also takes the same approach, that whereas the Haganah opposed attacks on the British and the Irgun opposed attacks on the British up until that point, now both of them will say, it's kosher, you can attack British installations. Which means then, what's the difference between the Irgun and the Haganah? Not much. Okay, so it helps the Haganah to have another organization that they can blame for the worst of its own actions. And this will extend for about 3 months, from May 18th of 39 up until August 31st. That in those 3 months, Ben-Gurion gives the go-ahead for assaults on British patrol boats, on telegraph and telephone wires, on empty British police installations, not to kill British officers, but to destroy infrastructure on the grounds that Britain is now the enemy because they're blocking Jewish immigration. The Irgun is doing worse. They're okay with even killing people. Okay. So, with Raziel in prison and the white paper in place, what is the Irgun doing other than blowing up the occasional British installation? They are bringing Jews in violation of the white paper. The Aliyah Bet, the Ha'apala, the illegal immigration, everyone wants to take credit for it. The Haganah would later want to take credit for it. Every political body within the Yishuv will want to say, we helped bring in Jews illegally. In truth, the Irgun was the primary organization doing it in 38 and 39, on a series of about 50-some-odd boats between 38 and 41 that snuck through. About 18,000 Jews made it to Eretz Israel under their auspices, which is a significant number of people. It's now not... getting out of Europe wasn't a problem at that time. It was getting into Palestine that was the problem. Getting out of Europe is a problem after 41-ish, because then the Nazis closed the borders. Okay, so... No. So on August 31st, 1939, the day before the war starts, the British go on a massive hunt for Irgun high-ranking officials, and they arrest a whole bunch of them, including Avraham Stern. Avraham Stern was a poet, a classicist, fluent in the Greek and Latin and the writings of Homer, and was a tremendous mind, but a little bit of a lunatic. And yeah, so he was one of the leaders of the Irgun from its founding in 1937 up until 39 and his arrest. After he was arrested, so a day later, England Germany invades Poland, and 2 days after that, on September 3rd, England goes to war with Germany. With England going to war with Germany, the question becomes, what will the British do with these underground Yishuv fighters who are in their custody? They could hold them indefinitely. There's all sorts of reasons to hold them indefinitely. But on the other hand, the British are also interested in using these people for their own military advantage. I mean, if these are people who are fighters, who are willing to kill and potentially lose their own lives in the cause of Jewish nationalism, and the thinking is that the Nazis are the ultimate enemy of the Jews, then let's take these people to our advantage and put them out in the field. Okay, so that's what that will in fact happen in some cases. So on October 24th, 1939, David Raziel, the commander of the Irgun, is taken in shackles out of prison and brought through the front door of the King David Hotel, plopped down in the restaurant in the back on the terrace, and in front of him are several British intelligence officers and Pinchas Rutenberg, one of the leaders of the Yishuv. And it's basically said to him, "Nu, Raziel, if you promise to be loyal to the cause of England in this world war, and you'll put it down in writing that your people will be committed to British victory, then we'll let you out of jail. And we'll think about what you're going to do next." So Raziel signs off on it and says that Irgun is now in favor of a British victory in World War against German Nazism, and we're going to put all of our resources, human resources and material resources, at the disposal of the British war effort. Okay. So, does that make sense? Yeah, makes sense enough, all right? It's what the mainstream Yishuv leadership wanted, and now the Irgun is going along for the ride. What does Jabotinsky think? He also thinks that. Jabotinsky, for all of his complaints over the years about how the British were stabbing the Zionists in the back, to his dying day, he fully recognized that the British were the ones who were most capable of supporting Zionism from an imperial perspective, that no other European power was ever going to do for the Jews what England had done. And in a world war, Germany is the ultimate enemy, and England is our friend. Not a very beloved friend, but our friend. So, all is well in the world. It would seem. That the Irgun is going to simmer down and no longer attack British installations, and certainly the Haganah is not going to, and some people are going to volunteer for service in the British Army. Well, the trouble is that some people were still in jail. The most important one is Avraham Stern. Avraham Stern is not released from prison until May of 1940. he was bitter over the fact that he was stuck in prison a lot longer than Raziel was. And when he gets out of prison, he is furious over what he feels is a betrayal of the cause of Jewish nationalism. He wants the fight against England to continue even during the war. And then in his viewpoint, the Nazis were Jew haters, but England is the enemy of the Jewish people. And that the Jew haters can be convinced to do something, the Jew hater can be manipulated to the advantage of Jewish nationalism by offering some kind of a deal with them in exchange for cooperation, which will then force the British to allow for Jewish statehood. That's... Okay, so what happened was... Very flawed, and let's see what happens with Jabotinsky. So Jabotinsky is in New York, and when Stern gets out of jail and he's complaining, Raziel doesn't like this. He resigns as the commander of the Irgun, and Stern takes over the Irgun for about a week. And then, actually about a month, until middle of July. And then a letter comes in from Jabotinsky saying to Stern, relinquish control, give it back to Raziel, and shut up. And your ideas are flawed. But despite the fact that Jabotinsky, the great Jabotinsky, issued his pronouncement, Stern wasn't interested. And he was not...
Was that statement?
Yes, it was public knowledge. But Stern didn't care. And so he's going to break away. Jabotinsky dies about 2 weeks later, has a massive heart attack upstate New York at one of the Beitar camps, dies in a hospital, is buried out at Wellwood, and he's out of the picture. So Stern now decides, we're going to make a breakaway organization. Raziel can have his Irgun. We're running away. We're doing our own thing. Now, there are several reasons why this occurred. One, Stern was not a right-winger. As we'll see in a moment, Stern was really all over the map. He was an extreme right-winger and extreme left-winger simultaneously. He had a love for fascism, and a love for communism. So he was all over the ideological map. And he did not want, moreover, the Underground Fighters organization to be beholden to a above-ground political party. Not any political party. And all the more so, not a specific political party, namely the right-wing revisionists. He did not like the fact that between 37 and 40, the Irgun was under the thumb of the Hatzohar, Hatzionut HaRevisionistis, in Israel. So there's the idea here is Hatzohar is the legal political party, Beitar is the legal youth organization, the Irgun was an illegal paramilitary organization, and ostensibly they're all one big happy family. But in the eyes of Avram Stern, he doesn't want that. He wants the fighters to be independent and do what they want to do without guidance from civilian leadership.
Is he
in I believe he was from Poland. Maybe he was from Lithuania. I'm not sure where he was born, but he came to Eretz Yisrael in the 1920s.
Is he an anarchist?
No, because he wanted to be in control.
Oh.
So, what happens next? He forms an organization called Irgun Tzva'i Le'umi BeYisrael. Not BeEretz Yisrael, BeYisrael. Okay? He dropped the Eretz.
Why?
Because you have to have a different name. Okay, so he wants to be the real Irgun, but he realizes it's a mistake. A month later, they change the name to Lochamei Cherut Yisrael, and the acronym Lehi, Freedom Fighters of Israel.
The Lehi is Stern.
Yes. Now, they have a logo, which is a fist with the two fingers up in front of a map of the broader historic Eretz Yisrael, which is a holdover from the days of the Irgun, which wanted a Jewish state on both sides of the Jordan. So the territorial maximalism has been sustained, and maybe even more so, because the Jabotinsky Irgun territorial maximalism was the borders of 1918 British Palestine. the borders of Lehi's Eretz Yisrael is Minahar Mitzrayim, but Hanahar Hagadol, Nahar Prat. Okay, that's pretty big. All right. Well, what...
Was those borders ever realized?
No, of course not. They were never realized. So let's then read the Ikarei HaTefiya. So there were 18 principles of the Lehi platform. And we'll go through them one at a time, and then we'll see what happens to Stern himself. Ikarei HaTechiya, the principles of the revival, of the renaissance of the Jewish nation. One, Ha'am, the people. Am Yisrael, hu Am Segula, we're a destined people, a chosen people. Yotzer Dat HaYichud, the founders of the religions of monotheism. Mechokek Musar HaNaviim, the promulgators of the Musar, the ethical ways of the prophets. Noset Tabut Olam, a people of a humane and universal culture. Gadol b'mesorat mesirut hanefesh, a people that has long suffered and has been willing to sacrifice for their national cause. Biritzon hachaim v'koach hasevel, in a will for life, but a willingness to sustain difficulties. Be'or rucho b'bitchono b'geula, believing in our eventual redemption. Okay, so number one is nationalism, the nation. So if you're a traditionalist, and you what is, if you're a traditional Jew, what is principle number one? Is it the Am? No. What is it? Yeah, the Torah, God, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Okay, but notice, even though the nation is number one, included in the first principle are references to religion,
right,
to, you know, to monotheism and to the Musar HaNaviim. Stern himself was a religious man in his last few years. I wouldn't say that he was a Shomer Mitzvot Jew his whole life. I mean, he died at the age of 34, 35, but he was young. He was born 1907 and get killed in 42. But when he got married, it was which he got married in the late 30s, mid-30s, he decided that I'm going to have a traditional Jewish house, keep kosher in the holidays. For him, it was important that Judaism infuse his nationalism and his personal life. Okay. Then, number two, Hamechorah, the homeland, who Eretz Israel, the land of Israel, B'tchumeha Mefurashim B'Torah, according to the boundaries that are enumerated in the Bible, not according to the British map of 1918, but the Bible. From the river of Egypt to the Euphrates. He Eretz HaChaim, Ba'yishkon Lebetach Am HaEvri Kulo. This is the Eretz HaChaim. Now, what is the Eretz HaChaim according to tradition?
Cemetery, no?
So that's a Beis HaChaim. Eretz HaChaim, according to the traditional interpretation of, let's say, Psalm 27, is the afterworld, the hereafter, the Olam Haba. But for Stern, the Eretz HaChaim is Eretz Yisrael and the Olam Hazeh. Okay? Gimel, 3. At Eretz Yisrael, Kavash Yisrael v'cherev. The land of Israel was conquered by the Jewish people by the sword. Ba haya la'am, u'ba bilvad yeshuv l'tchia. Only in the land of Israel did we become a people, and only there will we have our renaissance. So this is a controversial point.
He's referring to Joshua.
But in truth, right, in truth, this is not only a Sternist position, this is actually a Ben-Gurion position as well. That the Jewish people become a people not in Mitzrayim, okay, during the Yetziat Mitzrayim, the Exodus, but rather we become a people in Eretz Yisrael. Now, the truth is, the biblical minimalists, the ones who are not the traditional believers, but the minimalists, will say that what? That there never was an Exodus, and that how did the nation of Israel emerge? It morphed out of Canaanitism in Eretz Yisrael. So that's a sort of an anti-religious, yes, that's an anti-religious mainstream biblical scholarship position in the 20th and 21st century.
That they didn't go to Egypt.
Right. The Canaanites became the Israelites over time. That's not what Stern is saying. Stern's not a denier of the Bible. But what he is saying is everything that happened before Joshua's conquest is kind of irrelevant. What matters is you came to the land and you beat the hell out of the native inhabitants and we took it over. Okay, and only in Israel will there be a renaissance. What this means is that diaspora nationalism is bogus. It doesn't count. It's a stupid idea. That for the Shimon Dubnovs of the world who think that you can have centers of Jewish nationalism and pride in Russia, America, here, there, you can't have it. You can only have Tchia in the Holy Land. Okay. Now, Lefikach Yesh Li Yisrael V'rak Lo Zechut HaBa'alut Al Eretz Yisrael. Only to the Jews, to Am Yisrael, is there the right of possession in the land of Israel. Zechut Zu Hi Mukhletet. This is an absolute matter. Meaning, don't tell me that binationalism is Zionism. It's not. No other group can have national rights in Eretz Yisrael. That our national rights in Israel have not expired, meaning even though it's been a long time since the destruction of the Jewish Commonwealth in antiquity, it didn't expire and it will never expire. This is an absolute matter. Then, Dalad, Hayiud, the goal, the destiny. Number one, Geulat Aris, the redemption of the land. Number two, Tikumat Malchut, a rising of a kingdom, Malchut. Now notice the word Malchut as opposed to Memshala. Memshala means government. Like today, who's the Rosh HaMemshala? Netanyahu, he's the head of government. Malchut is something much more grandiose. And that's what Stern has in mind. Okay, yeah, yeah. Now, the third, Techiyat HaUma, the revival of the nation, Ein Tekuma Malchut below Gulat Aretz. You can't have the kingdom without the redemption of the land. And you can't have the resurrection of the people without the rising up of the kingdom. So you can't have one without the other. If you want to have the kingdom, you got to have the land. If you want to have the people, you have to have the kingdom. So this is an attack on what type of Zionism? Gradualist Zionism. What does gradualist Zionism have to say? Well, Weizmann is the great exponent of this. That let's take our time in building up the yeshuv under international auspices with the free flow of immigration. The numbers will get better, and eventually, we'll be in a position to have statehood. So that was the general Zionist point of view from the 1900s through the 1930s.
Correct.
So what this is saying is, we need a kingdom, and we need to actively pursue it in the here and now. Put the demographics aside, even if they don't work out, which, by the way, is the lunacy of the whole thing, and let's go for broke and have a malchut, a kingdom. Then, ve'ele tafkidei hayagun b'tor hamilchama v'akibush. These are the roles to be played by our irgun, our organization, in the war and the conquest. So now principle number five. Chinuch, education. Chinuch ha'am li'ahavat ha'cherut. So educating the people to love freedom. V'tefuach ne'amanut kena'it l'kinyanav ha'nitzchiyim. And building up feelings of zealotry, kana'ut, for the sake of our eternal victory. Hashrashat rayon ki gora la'am natun bi'adavu. Teaching, implanting into the hearts and minds of the people the notion that their destiny is in their own hands. Meaning, don't think I can be passive because, after all, I don't control my own affairs. You know, there are world powers that are governing these countries and I'm just a little simple Jew. A lot of people in the yeshuv thought that way. Mighty England, who are we to boss around mighty England? No. What the Lachi wants you to believe is that you can control your own destiny, even if there's a world power that is supposedly in control of the country. Then, Chidush HaKara, Sofa Hasayafa Sefer, Nitnu Mechurakim HaShamayim. The notion of the Sayaf and the Sefer, the sword and the book. The Safra V'Saifa is a Talmudic expression, and it's the journal, the Torah journal, put out by the Hesder Yeshivas. Safra V'Saifa. The book and the sword go together. Okay, then, number six, Achdut, unity. This is going to be a tricky one, because bear in mind, this is a breakaway organization. So a breakaway organization teaching you about Achdut is an element of hypocrisy. All right, so what does he say? Let's find out. So, Ichud Ha'am Kulo, the unification of the whole people, saviv digla shel tnuat ha'cherut ha'ivrit, around the flag of the freedom of the Hebrew peoples, shimush b'geonuyotam ma'amadam u'me'odam shel yechidim, v'kevan, I can't even read this. print is terrible. All right, the point of the Achdut is they want to rally people around the flag of national liberation, which means we have our ideology, and we may now be a fringe organization, but we have to educate people to our way of thinking such that with the right re-education, there will be unity with the doctrines that we're espousing, not that the other guy is espousing. Will this ever be achieved? Not really. The Lehi will remain a fringe partner in the liberation of Eretz Israel. Yeah.
Did each one of these different militia groups have a manifesto like this?
Okay, so the answer to that is not really. The Lehi had this. The Irgun will put out a manifesto in 1944 when they start their revolt. And maybe in 2-3 weeks from now, we're going to read that, not in full, but we're going to read a big chunk of it. And I remember I went to the museum, the Irgun Museum, and they had one of the original pamphlets on the wall. And I took a picture of it. I'm not sure you were allowed to use photography, but I took a picture of it. I have it on my phone, of the original Irgun Manifesto when Begin was in charge, the merid of the Noor HaIvri.
But whose consumption?
Okay, so sometimes it's not an issue of whose consumption it's for. Sometimes it's an issue of people have these deeply held feelings and they want to just get it out there. So Avram Stern is writing this, not necessarily because he needs to convince the whole world of these 18 principles, but it's what he believes in, and he's a poet and a scholar and a philosopher and a terrorist, and so he wants to let everyone know, this is my attitude. My attitude. Okay.
So the Irgun was sort of moderate compared to the left.
Moderate in the sense that during the war, they were more rational in their calculations about how to deal with the British.
They attacked the British?
No, not at all. Not from September of 1939 until February of 1944.
So, the Stern...
Did, certainly, did. Absolutely did, yeah. Okay, 7. Kritut. So, kritat kritut in kol ham unyanim b'melchamet ha'irgun ha'muchanim l'sayalob misharim. We're ready to make deals with all international entities that are willing to support our goals. Well, that may well include Nazi Germany and fascist Italy. So we'll get to that in a second. I'll explain when we get to it. Then 8, koach, strength, force. So, koach alochem hadar tov b'mukhuram v'tfutzot, the strength and power of the fighter in the land of Israel and in the diaspora, b'machteret Uve Kasri Katin, underground and above ground, Liotot Svag Ula Ivri Al Diglo Nishko Mifkadav. So the goal here of the Lehi is to be the colonel of the Tzvag Ula, the redeeming army. That this is not intended to remain an underground fighters organization forever. This is to become the army of Israel. The army of Israel. It's pretty bold. Big time goal that they're espousing for themselves. Not really, no. Then milchama, war, milchemet tamid b'chol hamdim l'satan l'kayum hayud, eternal perpetual war, milchemet tamid. Okay, when we think of tamid in Judaism, what do you think of tamid? The ner tamid, the korban tamid, are religious things. Milchemet tamid, perpetual war. Midor Lador, yeah. So this is perpetual war against anyone who stands in our way. That's tough language. Then kibush. Kibush ha-mukhura midei zarim la-chuzat olam. Conquest of the homeland from the foreign interlopers. Then, the third piece. Ve'ele tafkidei ha-tenua b'torah ha-dnut ha-gula. This is the role of our movement in the matter of sovereignty and redemption. So Yud Aleph. Adnut, sovereignty. Chidusha adnut ha'evrit al aretz ha'geula. Sovereignty over the redeemed land. That sounds good. Mishtar ha'tzedek, justice. So the implementation of justice. Mishtar, hakamat mishtar chevrati beruach musar Yisrael va'tzedek v'anavui. So following the ways and ethics of the prophets. Mishtar zelo yeh ra'av umuvtal. There shall be no hunger and no unemployment. We shall live in brotherhood, kavod with the human dignity, v'rayut in brotherhood and in friendship. Kol b'nei ha'umah b'asher hem b'aneha, to Mofet Lagoyim, we shall be a sign for the nations, a light unto the nations, in our brotherhood, in the way we deal with things. Now, this idea of no hunger and no unemployment, that's the left wing Avraham Stern. That's the socialism and borderline communism that Stern really believed in. Okay, then. Ha-chayat ha-shmamot. So, binyan ha-charavot va-chayot ha-shmamot la-aliyat ha-milyonim, priyotam riviyotam. The idea is bringing back the to life the oppressed peoples, the beleaguered peoples, the downtrodden peoples among the Jews of the world, and giving them new hope and a new lease on life in Eretz Yisrael. Yud Dalad, Mishpat HaZarim, the rule of the foreigners. Judgment of the foreigners, meaning the non-Jewish population. So, Pitron Bayat HaZarim, Chilufei HaChlusia, transfer of population. The Lehi believes in transfer of population. The Irgun did not. This is very important. The Irgun, despite being a right-wing organization, had as its guiding light Vladimir Jabotinsky, who was really a European liberal at heart, and believed in equal rights for all people, all citizens, and did not believe in dispossessing the Arab population. He believed in denying them any national hope, any national aspirations, with an iron wall of Zionism against an Arab national movement, but they can have rights of citizenship, and they shall not be dispossessed. In this regard, Jabotinsky was much more moderate even than Ben-Gurion, who in 1948 will see to it that the Arabs of Lod and Ramla are expelled, and there's a massive transfer of population during the course of the war. The Lehi believes openly in a transfer of population because it wants an ethnically homogeneous Jewish kingdom. Jews come in, the Goyim go out. Stern was accused of racism on account of this. So it's a funny thing. He's a fascist, but he's a communist or socialist, but he's a racist. He's everything, all wrapped into one. Yeah. So he looked favorably upon Italian fascism.
He spent time in Italy.
He enjoyed himself in Italy.
Who doesn't? But the thing is, it sounds a little bit like Yibusha Aretz.
Yes, yes, he's Joshua.
That kind of
absolutely. So, Kibbutz Galiot, in gathering of the exiles. Kibbutz Galiot Shalem Malchut Yisrael, a complete ingathering. So he's rejecting the notion of Jews remaining in the diaspora. Shalem, a complete.
But
the difference is Ben-Gurion wanted good productive Zionists to come to Eretz Yisrael. He didn't want the loafers to show up. He denied that there could be a Jewish future in the Chutz La'aretz, but he didn't really want every last no-goodnik to show up. Whereas this is saying every last Jew is going to show up in a massive wave of immigration. And then Shilton, rulership. Ha'adarat ha'am ha'ivri lihyoto gorem tzva'i, medini tabuti v'kalkali rishon v'ma'alab mizrach v'chofei ha'yam ha'tichon. So the Jews should have a state, and this state shall be a first-rate power in the Middle East and in the Mediterranean region. So what Lehi was proposing here was really the modern state of Israel, the post-1967 Israel, a big country that bosses around the Arab world and is the most powerful army in the region. In the 1940s, most Zionists were just hopeful, let's survive an Arab onslaught. Let's just get independence. Lehi is thinking big. We're going to be a powerhouse in this part of the world. Then 17, Techiya. Hachayat ha-lashon ha-ivrit b'fi kol ha'am. Everybody speaking Hebrew. Chidush ha-atzmuti ha-historit v'aruchanit shel Yisrael, tzaruf ha-ofi ha-lu'mi b'kor ha-techiya. And purging all the dross out of the personality of the Jew, transforming the Jew in the course of independence. So in many ways, not just linguistically, but all the unwanted features of the diaspora shall be eliminated from the character of the Jew who lives in Israel. But the truth is, Ben-Gurion also wanted that. He wanted to get rid of the diaspora mentality, the diaspora affectations. Then lastly, Habayit. Binyan Habayit Hashlishi, Kisemel, Latur HaGeula, Hashlema. So building the third temple as a sign of the complete redemption. Now notice, he doesn't say building the third temple for the sake of fulfilling the mitzvot, for God's Torah, because it's a chiyuv midoraisa. You know, there's no halachic language here. Rather, the third temple is a sign of the complete redemption. Who preempted Lehi? Who said this many years earlier? No, Theodor Herzl. Theodor Herzl, in Alt New Land, proposed the building of the third temple. But he didn't think it was going to have animal sacrifices with a Kohen with blood on the floor. No, he thought of it as like a temple Emmanuel, but on the Harabait, you know, with a choir and people wearing robes and singing, you know, Western style liturgical music. So there's a big question about what he thought, but there's reason to suspect he doesn't think they would be korbanot. Okay, so what happens with Lehi? Enough with their Ikarei Techiya. So Lehi makes an attempt to connect with Italy in 1940 by approaching the consul general in Jerusalem. Well, through an intermediary, they try to approach Italy. Then in early 41, there's an attempt made to approach the Nazis.
You're kidding.
Yes, in Beirut. In Vichy, France, so Vichy, Lebanon, had Nazi officials there, and there was an attempt to contact them. It fell flat. Then there was a further attempt in December of 41, to contact the Nazis in Turkey, and that also fell flat.
But
so
how could he want to do that?
Okay. All right. So here's the important thing to understand. Prior to an awareness of the final solution, although plenty of people recognized, in fact, most Jews recognized the Nazis as the worst mortal foe of the Jewish people have ever faced, not everyone wanted to believe that. And the likes of Lehi, Avram Stern, he believed that closing the gates to Eretz Yisrael was as big a sin as anything the Nazis had done thus far. Had he lived a few more years and known about the Wannsee Conference and Auschwitz, probably his mind would have been a little bit different. But he didn't live to see that.
So he didn't think the signs that went on with the Nuremberg Laws and the beatings and everything.
It's all Jew hatred, but Jew hatred with an agenda of expulsion. And the agenda of expulsion actually could work in the favor of Jewish nationalism, because it means Jews leaving Europe and going to Eretz Israel. But all these efforts came to naught. However, they are remembered in the historiography and are a way of besmirching Zionism as being in cahoots with Nazism. So for all the BDS people out there who want to say that Zionism is the devil, they'll point to these instances of a half-baked attempt by Lehi, a fringe organization, to contact the Germans as proof of their assertions. That's also true, but that goes back a little bit further. So, now, Lehi has a problem. Lehi's problem is, what is it going to do? It wants to attack the British, but it needs money, and it doesn't have any. They confiscated some weaponry during their break from the Irgun, but not all that much, and they need to fund their operatives who can't have livelihoods in the open economy because they're in hiding effectively. And so they need to purchase weapons, they need to purchase safe houses, and the like. So Irgun goes to the United States to promote rescue of European Jews, and that's Peter Burks and Hillel Cook. We're going to talk about that next week. But Lehi decides to rob banks. So they go into the bank robbing business, multiple infamous case of a heist, stealing Palestine pounds, the local currency. And unfortunately, from banks, the Anglo-Palestine Bank and this bank, that bank, unfortunately in the process, they killed several Jews. And they became anathema to the mainstream yeshuv, that these are just a bunch of cutthroats, bank robbers, who are doing no good. Okay, so their reputation was in the gutter, and it was deserved.
Do the other groups do things like that?
No.
The Jews?
Generally not, no.
I mean deliberate
No.
Irgun didn't do it.
No, no. So that's 1946. We're going to get to that eventually. It was a combination of Irgun and Lehi, and the truth is Haganah even approved of it ahead of time, but they don't admit that. So,
what did they approve?
The bombing of the King David Hotel. Yesh Omrim.
Must have been the Dan Hotel.
I think they
wanted to get out. Yes. So, no, so what happened was that Lehi began its attacks, and it was not very effective in killing too many British, but they roused the ire of the British establishment, including the police, the CID, the Criminal Investigation Division, which is the most anti-Jewish of all the police officers in Eretz Yisrael. And they're on the tail of the leadership of the Lehi, of the Stern Gang. And they're arresting this one and arresting that one and torturing them and trying to extract information. And the problem is the Stern Gang did not have as tight lips as they should have. The Irgun tended to be very good about not spilling the beans. But the Lehi had problems in keeping their secrets. So that's why ultimately, it's not easy. The personality, whatever it is, they sometimes interrogation methods work. They were that coercive. So the Lehi killed in an explosion in late 41, two very high-ranking police officers in Eretz Yisrael. And this led to a serious, serious manhunt. They want to get Stern. They want to get Yair, as he was known. Yair. He was named after Elazar ben Yair of Masada. So here, Masada went down ignominiously. Stern would also go down the same way, basically. So he goes into hiding. But the police find out where he's hiding. How do they find out? They're eavesdropping on conversations between prisoners and their spouse when they come to do a visit. And they were able to hear an address in Tel Aviv. So they go to this address, and they're searching around, and they don't see anybody. It's the home of Moshe and Tova Savorai. But Jeffrey Morton, who is the head inspector, and his buddy Thomas Wilkin, they're looking around, and they see something that's unusual. They see a man's hat, but the man was in jail. He'd been in jail for 3 months. So why is a man's hat in this apartment if it's just a wife, you know, whose husband is in prison? And they see that there's a shaving kit, and it was wet. So there had been a man in here recently. So they open up the closet, and they see Stern is hiding among the dresses in the closet. And they cuff him.
But wait a minute, it wasn't his name on the couple wasn't named Stern.
No, it was Savorai. The husband was in jail. The wife was coming to visit him in jail. She was allowing Stern to hide out in her apartment.
Oh, okay.
He jumped from apartment to apartment every night. He never stayed in the same place twice. So they arrest him, and now we have a dispute. What happened next? The Sternists would argue that he was executed in cold blood by Morton. Morton claims it's not true. Stern tried to escape and jump out the window. And so he had no choice but to shoot him. The autopsy indicated that Morton's version of events is probably true, that he was killed during an escape attempt. And Morton was accused of all sorts of terrible things by Jews over the years, and he sued in court, libel lawsuits, and won 3 times to defend himself. The Lehi tried to kill him.
In what court did this great event occur?
British courts. So,
you should have made a movie out of that.
There might be one, I don't know. Well, if you go to the Lehi Museum, you'll see the movie there. It's a 20-minute movie in the Lehi Museum. So Morton and Wilkin were targeted for assassination. Morton, they tried to get him, they failed. Wilkin, they got him a few months later. Wilkin was an interesting character, Thomas Wilkin. He spoke Hebrew and Yiddish fluently. He was a Jewish expert among the Palestine police force. No, he was a goy gomer, but he was having a romantic relationship with Ber Baruchov's daughter, Shoshana. So here, a great Zionist thinker who died in 1917, but his daughter was the girlfriend of Wilkin, who killed Avram Stern and then was himself assassinated for good measure. Okay, so we've gotten to the end of Stern's life. Yeah.
What kind of women marry these kind of men?
I don't know.
Anything about his wife, his children?
Stern's wife was very devoted to the cause. She was a believer in his mission and was committed to his agenda for national liberation and knew that he was going to suffer a martyr's death. And that was that. He suffered a martyr's death. I don't believe he had kids. I'm not sure, actually. I don't know. Okay, so we'll stop here. Next time, what we'll discuss is what happens in terms of the other members of the underground. What happened to David Raziel and the Irgun? What was the fate of the Irgun during the war? And what happened to the Haganah and the mainstream in terms of fighting for the British?